which I will now open public hearing and ask Lisbeth to give us the lowdown, and then we'll invite, let's see, Representative King, so we'll get our witnesses up here. Please.
Chairman Shetterly and committee members, with House Bill 2033, what this is a result of discussions and things that went on during the interim, and during last session, we had Senate Bill 595 that was passed by the legislature and then vetoed by the governor. But what that bill was that there was the winery exemption bill, which gave a property tax exemption for the machinery and equipment used for making wine, and it was just restricted to wineries and ESU land. But over the 1999-2000 interim session, there was a group led by the Department of Revenue which discussed a variety of broader agricultural policy issues and tax policies. And primarily the interim group focused on the property tax system and if there was going to be an exemption, how exactly that would be funded. So the Department of Revenue surveyed counties to identify the agricultural processing accounts and the values then of the machinery and equipment and personal property on various accounts. So we have now a pretty good, at least a better database than we've ever had before on agricultural processing accounts. To refresh everybody's memory, under current law, the machinery and equipment that's used just in the planting or growing and harvesting are exempt from property taxation, but machinery and equipment that is used after the harvesting operation, okay, it's used in processing the farm good, then it becomes taxed at the real market value. So that's what we're dealing with today in this bill, is the processing, machinery, and equipment. So to kind of go through the key components of the bill, it is establishing an income tax credit or a corporate tax credit if the taxpayer is a corporation, for the machinery and equipment just used in farm processing. And there are certain criteria that are strict that need to be met. And to begin with, the machinery and equipment must be located on or adjacent to land which is specially assessed for farm use and owned and controlled by the farm operator. The machinery and equipment is used primarily for processing one of the two following conditions. So there's, you know, these strict conditions that must apply on the farm. To begin with, the farm operator has grown or raised at least one half of the total volume of the farm crop or livestock products processed with the machinery and equipment in three of the last five income tax years. So if they meet that way, then that qualifies them. Or another option is if the farm operator has grown or raised at least one-tenth of the total volume of farm crop or livestock products processed with the machinery and equipment for which the credit is claimed then in three of the last 5 years. So this is a smaller volume requirement that has to actually be grown and then processed. But what you also then have to have is that you have to have at least 50% of the volume of the farm product has to actually be grown or raised by the farm operator in three of the last five previous tax years. So this is really focusing this credit around processing that's on the farm, and that was a key discussion during the interim group. Now, the calculation of the tax credit then is computed by multiplying the effective property tax rate, and this is something that, you know, this credit is trying to be used by the everyday farmer who would not have access to all the different property tax rates that the county assessor would. So what they would do is then take their total property taxes that they have in their current year and divide it by their total assessed value on their property tax statement to come up with an effective property tax rate. So you take to calculate your credit then each year, you take your property tax rate times this adjusted basis of the qualified machinery and equipment. And this adjusted basis of the qualified machinery and equipment reflects any depreciation that's allowable for the current year. And for purposes of calculating that tax credit, you also have this adjusted basis can be increased by the cost of any qualified machinery and equipment that the taxpayer elects to expense under Section 179. So basically, you have this adjusted base, but each year you will be adding then your amount that you have expensed for that particular machinery and equipment. A tax credit is not allowed if the machinery and equipment is fully depreciated for the tax year. And this tax credit can be carried forward for 4 years, and it applies beginning January 1st, 2002. The real machinery and equipment, there's another section of the bill, Section 7, which is another kind of key component in addition to the tax credit. And this is basically saying for those processors that qualify for the credit, the real machinery and equipment that is used for on-farm processing activities shall be classified on the county tax roll as farm use machinery and equipment. So if it was industrial, it can have a change in its classification to farm use machinery and equipment. And then also the owner of this property may elect to exclude the income approach to valuation in appraising the property. It's going to apply to property tax years also beginning July 1st, 2002. Just so everyone's clear, I also gave you a little breakdown of an example just so you can have an understanding of how the credit will work on an annual basis. And so to just kind of quickly summarize that, if you have like a machinery and equipment that its initial cost is like $100,000, and just assuming a tax rate of like $15, the $100,000 in this first example here would be depreciated over 10 years, and then the estimated credit amount over that 10-year period would be $6,781. And that's assuming 150% of the declining balance method. And there would be no 179 expense in this example. But as you can see, if you do have these expenses, the 179 expense, if you spent, say, 20%, so you, in the first year, expense $20,000, then your unadjusted basis goes from $100,000 to $80,000. And then if you add back in every year, then the credit with the 179 expense, your credit amount over that entire period of time would grow from the $6,781 to the $8,725. So the amount of expense that you are having taken out in that first year and it is having an effect on the credit. And then as you see, the maximum amount is roughly $24,000 right now, $25,000 in the future. So if you look at increasing that, the maximum amount that you can have for a cost expense is greatly going to be affecting then the amount of credit that you are going to be providing these ag processors. So to just give you the revenue aspect of it, we made various assumptions. Ed Waters and I worked together on this, and we basically estimated that for the 2001-03 biennium, the state revenue reduction from this ag processing credit would be about $350,000 and more than $1 million in the 2003-05 biennium. And then with the estimate for just kind of giving you some of the issues with Section 7, which is a little bit unclear, if property is currently classified as industrial and it has its classification then changed to farm use machinery and equipment, some of that machinery and equipment may be considered farm use and then would be removed from the county tax rolls, reducing local revenue. In addition, what you would be seeing then is a change property ratio for an industrial property is currently quite close to one in most counties. And if you change then your classification to farm use machinery and equipment, you're going to be getting a lower change property ratio for farm use. And then if you do have new machinery and equipment that is purchased for the processing facility, you're going to have the amount of the value that's actually added to the tax rolls would be reduced by having this change in classification.
Okay. Yes, Representative Hass.
Section 179.
Mm-hmm.
One sentence refresher portion.
Yeah, it's just the amount that you can expense that you want to get your depreciation quickly. So you will depreciate all that in a given year.
Section 179 is
IRS.
Internal Revenue Code.
Yeah.
Right. And the idea is so that
to get your depreciation early, quickly.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Witt.
So, Elizabeth, is it correct that with an accelerated depreciation, the amount of the tax credit that ultimately would be earned under this bill becomes significantly less? Is that, am I correct to understand it that way?
Well...
Whether with a straight line depreciation, the tax, presumed tax would be higher, you'd have an offsetting credit, right? So what is the effect of doing a quicker depreciation than a straight line depreciation?
Well, Representative Witt, you get it more in the beginning, so you're getting it more upfront.
Okay.
Where it's even in the straight line depreciation.
I understand that.
But its impact on the credit.
What is the impact on the credit, though? Is there any impact on the ultimate credit that this bill would provide, the income tax credit that this bill would provide?
Representative Witt, I don't think so, because it's going to be the same. The total depreciation is going to be the same.
Yeah, and the credit is equal to the amount of property taxes that would be paid, correct?
Representative Witt, no. Let me make sure that's clear. This is not based on the property taxes. Okay, we're using this effective property tax rate, but we're using the cost, like in this example, of just what you would pay in a given year for your new machinery and equipment. That cost may not be the same thing as what the county assessor is putting on as real market value, and then he adjusts it again for the property change ratio and sets it at a maximum assessed value. So it is not linked. There is not a check at all that says, okay, in a given year, this is my credit amount. Say it's, $2,000, but my property taxes are only $1,500. There's not a connection there. You do not have to make a final check where you go and say, my credit is this amount, but my property taxes were this amount. And so that's not the way the bill is written. There's not a...
All right, well, in Section 3... Paragraph 6 on page 2.
I see. Why don't you refer to, if you would, to the dash 2s, because they replaced that portion of the bill.
That portion of the bill's been replaced.
Yeah, the only thing that's left of the original bill is sections 5 to the end.
We're looking at 203, 3-2.
1 and 2 is still there.
Okay, yeah. 203, 3-2, yeah.
Yeah,
so we're talking about on page 3 of the dash 2 amendments. On page 3, on paragraph 6, that's been changed, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We're here now, makes reference to section 1, so okay. I guess I'll have to read through that, and then if I have a question on it.
Yeah. I think some of this may come up in testimony, too. I'm sure Dexter is listening as well.
He's on his way, I'm sure.
Start the clock.
Just see, it's about...
Representative Bates.
Just so I at least get the gist of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
On page 3, line 4, the amount of the credit shall be computed by multiplying the effective property tax rate by adjusting the base of the qualified machinery equipment. I assume you're looking at that and you're trying to estimate roughly, Dexter, no, roughly what you expect the local property tax to be on that equipment. You're trying to roughly match the two and give them a credit for it.
Representative Bates, that's correct, and then that was the philosophy behind this bill. I think the thing, though, that made us made this group move to the way it is written now is that if you look at your property tax statement for these processors, they don't have all these machinery and equipment all separated out. So this would be something that the county assessor would then have to report to the taxpayer in order to get him information that he needs in order to calculate an income tax credit. So this was a way in which you could have a proxy for the property taxes that are paid with information that he has from his income taxes.
I understand that. Thank you.
Okay, let's first invite Representative King to join us. Welcome.
Thank you. My... Representative Al King, House District 44, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of the wine growers from House Bill 2033. Just real quickly, when I owned a little company, I really hated to pay personal property taxes on property that was really my business. I felt that business made more sense than the personal property tax. But go on to the bill. The Oregon's, you know, wine growers are, you know, different than a lot of other businesses. A lot of times they're, you know, they're small farms and they're not shipping, you know, their products off to a behemoth manufacturing plant. You know, a lot of times it's right on the property, and I think that you know, this bill will give a chance to help the small winery get going. Right now, Oregon I think we've left the infancy stage of the industry, but we're still a footnote, you know, in an international scheme of the wine industry, and it's a positive footnote. We want to encourage that. I think that Oregon does get a substantial payback by helping, you know, relieve this expense, you know, for our small wineries, because I think a number of you have seen the property values of wineries in Oregon have gone up many fold in the last decade, and Oregon certainly gets a payback from that. The other thing also is that when that winery is successful, it's going to be generating income, for a lot of people, including the owners of the winery, but also the people they employ. And a successful winery is going to be a tax generator, an income tax generator, as well as a property tax generator in the future. So I think there's a payback, for that. That it's not just, are we letting go a revenue source. I think it comes back to us many times. So I think there's a good chance to help this industry.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Representative King? Yes, Representative Wicker.
Thank you. Representative, do you know other states around us that, like Washington or California in particular, that are heavily in the business of growing grapes and making wine? Do they have similar provisions in their laws?
No, I'm not an expert on their provisions. I think that there would be some parallels between us and Washington. But California, really is a real player, in the international industry, and they do, have a number of wine industries that are behemoths there. On the other hand, they still are having a number of people that are small producers as well. So I'd be interested in that, but I'm not an expert on their policies.
Representative Bates.
My district has a large number of wine growers now. Many of them are just getting started. A lot of the small ones ship all their product off to a central winery, which makes up the actual wine. I'm just trying to put through my mind what that would mean for those who have 20 or 30 acres and decide to get their own machinery, compared to those who have 10 or 15 acres and decide to ship off. One gets a tax credit, one does not. It sounds like to me the person receiving those on their farm might or might not get a tax credit. Is that, am I understanding this bill correctly?
For you may have some of your wine growers, and I've tasted their wine and I'm real fans of theirs. If they send off to a big industry, that wine winery would be in California. There aren't any big ones in your neighborhood. So I think that what we're talking about is not just the person that grows, which is an important component for a local winery, because they're going to need more than just what they can grow typically and how they capitalize. But when they ship off to their grapes to a winery that processes, it's that small winery. So we don't have any really big ones in the state. A few of them are fortunate to have some owners that have substantial capital resources, but so many of them are our mom and pop that are doing it the best go they can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dexter, let's use your time. Well, I guess if you can come forward, I think we have some technical questions. Did we not? Excuse me, that's
fine. You have to be informed enough to answer all of your questions. Oh, I'm not quite there yet.
Not either. I think it's driving me crazy.
One question I have, Dexter, in looking at dash 2 amendments, lines 13 to 14. We have farm operator means a person, and then it operates a farming business as defined in section 263A. What does Section 263A define? Does it define farming business or person?
Mr. Chair, members of Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office.
Do you remember?
Off the top of my head, frankly, I don't remember.
Okay, the reason I'm, and, the reason I'm getting at that, that wasn't just a trick question, but we have person there on line 13, and as I recall, in, is it in Chapter 174 that the statute says person means, and it means any, you know, entities as well, and so we're defining farm operator by reference to person. I'm trying to think then, if you look on page 2, lines 10 and 11, we have this reference to machinery and equipment owned by the farm operator or by a person who is related to the farm operator. Are we talking, are we using person again the same way there? And does that contemplate business entities that are related? Or is that a personal, okay, if you get where I'm going, I think I've reached the limits of my ability to articulate the question.
Mr. Chair, first of all, there is a definition of person in the Internal Revenue Code that also contemplates artificial entities like corporations and the like. And I think they, just off the top of my head, I think they are quite similar, probably not word for word exact. The use of the word person on page 2, would probably be the Section 174 definition of person. Seems to me it's not, you're not talking about the farm operator, you're talking about a person related to the farm operator. The other rules that are referenced there, Section 267 of the code, I believe, talk about, have some common ownership rules. Actually, Deborah may...
Deborah!
Relatives, okay.
We'll get everybody in this one for us, River.
Relatives. Oh, Deborah, if you want to come forward, let's get that.
But I think also, don't they,
am I tying myself including, to the thoughts here?
Including related entities that are related by common, by brother, sister, stock ownership arrangements, that sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. My recollection of IRC 267 is that it is related parties like parents, children, lineal descendants. I don't recall whether it covers entities such as corporations.
Okay, well, that's something we can find out. I just, I'm contemplating a scenario where somebody either contends as disqualified or ideally some, maybe some traps in there if we've got an entity that operates these things and this relates it to a, relates it, that's a bad word, but describes it according to a some sort of a relationship by consanguinity, is that the word? Yeah, I think so. Okay, that's all I had on that. Something to look at. Representative Witt.
Yeah, I had a question, Mr. Chairman. Is the purpose here or the effect of adding back to the depreciated value any 179 depreciation, the effect of that to give a bigger credit earlier in the process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, it gives you a larger credit than if you had not, if you didn't have that language, because the 179 expense is essentially an election to depreciate everything that's subject to the expensing rules all at once in the same year.
Over the long term, does it change the amount of the credit by putting this provision in the bill that says you have to add back any 179 depreciations?
Representative Witt, no, not over the long term, because once the property is fully depreciated, then the credit goes away, even though you technically still have that expensed amount.
Presumably, you're going to depreciate 100% of the property.
Mm-hmm.
All it does is it puts the credit earlier up in the depreciation time period. It gives you more credit earlier and less later. Is that the correct way to look at that?
I think the correct way is to actually say that you can claim the credit for the expensed amount, because the depreciation that you're going to claim each year is subtracted. The ordinary depreciation you'll claim each year is subtracted before you compute the credit. That you can see on lines 15 through 19 on page 3.
I can follow up, Mr.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Why couldn't the bill be written more effectively simply by giving a credit to the extent that you paid the property taxes on the property?
Representative Witt, I think actually the assessors can probably speak to that better, but the reason, my understanding is that it's difficult to easily compute what that amount of taxes is.
Even if you paid the tax?
It's to identify the particular property, because there's a property tax account for this kind of property, but it includes other property as well.
Okay. Any other questions for our techies?
I'm actually scared to ask questions here, okay? And the first question is, why do you allow these people to meet in the interim and do these things to us? That's the first question. She gave us a sheet here that I cannot look at the bill and make sense out of, okay? You have a copy of this?
Okay.
He gives you three scenarios. One in which there is no 179 expense, one there's a 20% 179 expense, and one there's a maximum 179 expense, which appears to be 25%. That must be what 179 allows, I guess. Each one of those show a total tax credit varying at the end of 11 years. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I have that sinking feeling here that I'm not going to be able to answer this question terribly well. I have not seen this sheet before.
Well, remember what you're dealing with here. It's, you know, a physician who doesn't like...
in other words, you could fool him.
Yeah, that you could say anything and get away with it here. I mean, there's no question about that. You could baffle me with some footwork and I'll never know what happened.
I think the difference, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that the basis is being depreciated differently in each of these examples.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I'll give it a shot.
Okay.
If you think of Section 179 expense as something other than depreciation, it's an amount that you just get to take and write off as a business expense against your income. So, for example, if I buy $50,000 worth of property and the maximum Section 179 expense for that year is $20,000, I take the $20,000 and deduct it as any other business expense. On my Schedule C, for example. The remainder of the cost of that asset is $30,000. That's what I'll depreciate over 7 years or 10 years. So that's what I'm depreciating. I'm calculating depreciation expense on the $30,000, and the $20,000 is gone. Under the bill, in order to get the full cost of that asset that I bought, $50,000, as a base for the credit, they're saying take the adjusted basis at the end of the year, add back that Section 179 expense that you claimed of $20,000, use that as the basis for figuring the credit. And once the $30,000 is completely gone, you stop getting the credit at all. But in that final year, you'll have a very small adjusted basis left. You'll add back the initial $20,000 that you claimed, figure your credit for that last year. And that's what the chart is showing here. In the first example, you have a person taking no Section 179 expense at all, so their adjusted basis each year, the first year would be $100,000, then they depreciate, take a depreciation expense of $7,500. The net of $92,500 is what they would use to figure the credit and on for the next 10 years. In the next example, they had $100,000. They took $20,000 off as a direct expense the first year they bought the property, so their basis then is $80,000. They'll take the $80,000 to figure the depreciation expense, but to get the credit, they're going to add back that $20,000 in each year to get a new base for figuring the credit.
Yeah. Representative Bates, the reason why that is because you've got this 179 expense that's not depreciated. Okay, if it was depreciated, then you would have what you have in the first example.
All the way through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, Representative Foote.
Is it correct that the amount that you can deduct as an expense under 179 is still taxed as property tax under Oregon law? In other words, if I buy a $100,000 piece of machinery and I can take a $25,000 expense under Section 179. When it came time to pay property taxes on my capital equipment, is it my property tax assessed that $100,000 less any normal depreciation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, they're not connected. The property taxes would be assessed on the assessed value of the property, which would not necessarily be the...
Okay, so there may be a better way of asking the question. The 179 expense really doesn't have anything to do with determining what the property tax is going to be, does it?
That's correct.
I mean, that's just a provision in the code to give a quicker write-off, an expense write-off, for businesses up to a certain dollar amount on an annual basis.
Okay. That's correct. But the other thing, I mean, the entire bill is really disconnected from the property tax because it doesn't use the actual rate. It uses this defined property tax rate that is not necessarily the same thing either.
If I can follow.
Yes, this is good.
So in other words, it would seem to make sense to add back the 179 expense to get at the intent of the bill here. I mean, it's not taking advantage of a loophole. What you're simply doing is they're correcting the fact that you can expense, the Internal Revenue Code lets you expense a significant chunk of the capital expenditure every year.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it seems to be, that strikes me as like it's a legitimate purpose to bring this back in to this bill for the purposes of determining policy on this bill, irrespective of where you end up on the policy, where you end up on the decision if this is good policy or not. It seems to make sense to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's simply sent there by the Internal Revenue Code is an opportunity for businesses to write off a certain amount of capital expenditure.
Section 179 serves its own purpose.
Right.
It serves a different purpose, and whether you take the 179 credit or not shouldn't affect the distinct purpose of this bill.
Right.
I think that's the argument.
Okay.
And that last column is with adjusted 179 added back in. That's what that last column is for, then, right? Mm-hmm.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Dexter.
You can't let these people meet anymore.
Oh, wouldn't you rather do it during session? Let's bring up Bernie, is it Lurch? Okay. And Jess Lyon. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Revenue Committee, thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to talk about House Bill 2033. My name is Bernie Lurch. I'm owner-operator of a vineyard winery operation in Hood River, out in the beautiful gorge. And I'm here appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. With me is Jess Lyons. He's our legal counsel, and he'll talk a little bit about the amendments later on. We, as Elizabeth has stated earlier, this House Bill 2033 came out of a work group authorized by Governor Kitzhaber to try to come up with some sort of a compromise based on the earlier bill from the last session that he had vetoed. Within that veto message, he had made it real clear that he was hopeful that we could come up with some sort of a compromise plan that would allow, provide a fair amount of incentive for farmers who are forced to, and let me, just as an aside, it's a tough time for farming right now. We're struggling to make profits that seem to be vanishing overnight on us. I'm involved with two different farming operations. I have the vineyard and the winery, but I also have an orchard property, and we grow pears and cherries and a lot of other things. And we're constantly forced to buy a lot of very expensive equipment. And a lot of it, we have no ability to really gain back the monies that we've put out. And to give you an example, I make a style of wine which requires a lot of aging, and that requires, in my hands, the style of wine that I make, I have to use a lot of oak barrels, and we will store these things for 3 years, and with some of the fortified wines that I make, we can often store these things for up to 5 years. And when you're talking about outlays of $500 for a small 59-gallon barrel, you're talking about a lot of capital outlay. And that, during that course of that time, we're not generating any revenue back. We're looking at a lot of goodwill that's building up over time. So anyway, I think one of the things the governor was hopeful to see that we could gain a little bit more viability. And I think our industry, the wine industry, is particularly one of the best in terms of adding value added back to a product. I think the fruit growers are trying desperately to do something similar, but they haven't quite found the proper venue. But the way this bill is written, I think it doesn't really bias any of the various different commodities. So I think they're all going to have the potential to gain back a lot of goodwill from this. Our feeling is that House Bill 2033 meets the objectives that the governor had outlined. It does provide an income tax credit, as Elizabeth and others have already discussed. I don't really need to go into that. The criterion that Jess will go into are clearly outlined in the bill as well. I think it does differentiate between the farmer who has processing equipment and the processor who may or may not have farmland associated with that and is attempting to be a farmer. Jess will talk about the attempts to make this a little bit more better defined for the farmer to how to actually interpret these rules. Oregon wineries and I think in farmers in general really strongly support House Bill 2033. It will hopefully remove the tax disincentive that we all have when we're purchasing a lot of very expensive equipment. House Bill 2033 doesn't discriminate between the various commodity groups and it doesn't really distinguish between real and personal property. With that said, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Representative Wick.
Could you tell us specifically in your industry, what percentage of the value comes after the grapes are picked on average?
Well, it depends partially on how long you actually go through an aging process. In a scenario that I outlined earlier where we're talking about barrel aging wines for upwards of 3 years, you're probably talking 80 to 90% comes after the fact. If you're looking at purchasing grapes for equivalent of 2,000 a ton, let's say just use that number, that would the gross value is going to be somewhere around $10 or $12 a ton, pardon me, $10 or $12 a bottle. And ultimately, you want to be able to see, let me rephrase that. That's not correct. We're looking at approximate cost of $150 a ton, or pardon me, there's 150 gallons per a ton. So we're looking at probably cost of about anywhere from $8 to $14 a case of wine, all right? And we would then take that wine and sell it, hopefully, for anywhere from $120 to $180 a case. So you can see that with that proper aging, you can, in fact, gain back quite a bit more in your expenses. If it's a shorter window, then obviously your wines aren't going to be worth as much, so your returns are going to be a lot less.
Do you know if there's any statistics about the importing or exporting of grapes from state to state? And out of Oregon in particular, that are processed elsewhere? In other words, is Oregon getting many grapes and having them processed somewhere else?
Right now there's probably more grapes that are sent out of the state than are brought into the state. But the numbers are still relatively small in comparison. We do on the order of 18,000 tons of grapes per year, and I would guess that probably no more than 5 or 6% of that gets shipped out of state. We might see 3 or 4% of that brought back in from other states.
And finally, do you know what percentage of the grapes that are processed into wine are processed on the land of the individual who's growing the grapes?
That's a number I couldn't really come up with, but I feel quite confident that we're talking about easily a majority. I mean, we're probably talking about exceptional majority. That may be 75 or 80%. The majority of wineries are operations very similar to mine, where you have a fixed amount of land associated with the winery. I'm not in the business of selling grapes. I'm in the business of making wine. So I process all the grapes that I grow, and I purchase some from outside. There are a very small percentage of wineries that don't have any associated land. But again, you're talking about a very small percentage of people. And even those sometimes will have a small amount of grapes that they may process. I would guess that the number of wineries that don't have an associated vineyard is probably less than 5% of the total.
Okay. Representative Bates.
Well, one of the difficulties facing farmers of all types and wine and vineyard owners, especially in my area, is they are competing in an international market now. And that market is difficult for them to compete against sometimes for lots of different reasons. Do you know if foreign countries, Chile, France, California, have these types of tax credits available for processing machinery?
Well, I know that California does, and as far as other foreign countries besides California, of course, the sense is virtually every country that's in the Southern Hemisphere right now has government subsidies. There is no way that Australia can bring in a Cab Merlot blend and sell it for under $5 a bottle. There's just no way. We know they're getting high levels of subsidies. Clearly, a lot of high levels of subsidies are going into the wine industry in Chile and Argentina. South Africa clearly has that. New Zealand, there really isn't a country that doesn't have some associated help with getting their product to market.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Lyon.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Lyon. I'm an attorney with Davis Wright Tremaine in Portland, and we represent, besides a number of individual wineries and vineyards and other food producers, we represent the Oregon Wine Growers Association, and I'm here on OWA's behalf in support of the bill. Bernie talked a little bit about the policies and practical impacts of this bill. I'm going to try to walk through some of the detail with you. The technical discussion earlier did a good job on most of those points, but hopefully I can clarify just a few questions that you have. The first thing that the bill aims to do is actually narrow the scope, so as Bernie suggested, so that we are talking about farmers who have farm production and are looking to enjoy the benefits that margins and processing can share to them, as opposed to selling a raw commodity away from the farm and letting someone else, perhaps out of the state, enjoy that benefit. So sections 3.1, particularly in subsection C and D, define the kinds of machinery and equipment that qualifies, and we're talking about personal property and or fixtures to buildings, but not buildings or any structural components of buildings that are used for post-harvest processing. This could be anything from crushing grapes and making wine, like in Bernie's business. It could be a nut producer who has facilities for cleaning and sorting nuts. It could be another entity that maybe dries fruit or makes jams and jellies on the farm. But again, buildings and structural components are excluded, and that's with that reference to Internal Revenue Code Section 1245 has to do with. And then you'll also note that any machinery and equipment for retail sales activities are excluded, so we're not talking about items within a tasting room. We're not talking about retail activities perhaps associated with a particular farm stand. Moving on to subsection 3.3, that's where we get into essentially the eligibility checklist. And again, this really narrows the scope of taxpayers that can participate in this to make sure we're talking about farmers. The reference to section 263A definitions provides that it's an actual trade of business, so this isn't a new exemption that it would be available to hobby farmers, but it has to be a legitimate trade or business in farming, and the farm operator then is a person or entity who operates that kind of venture. The equipment and machinery and equipment would have to be located and used on land that is specially assessed for farmland or contiguous to it and owned or leased by the operator. So again, this creates a distinction between folks who are processing their commodities on their farm from some other perhaps larger entity that might locate a large processing facility within a commercial district and within a city. And it also provides that this land has to be related to the entity that produced the crops. Then the last checkpoint, so to speak, is this relative volume test that the work group helped put together, again, to ensure that this is about a farmer processing his or her own crop. And I can run through an example of that for you just briefly, and it might help explain the rationale for that. If we considered a grape farmer with a 20-acre vineyard that produced, say, 40 tons of grapes each year, you might have 20 tons of Chardonnay grapes produced and 20 tons of Pinot Noir grapes, and he decided that he would start selling his grapes and wanted to start his own small winery operation in order to make Pinot Noir wine. So he could pass the test, the first half of the test, if he kept even only 5 tons of the Pinot Noir grapes and made wine from no more than 10 tons of grapes. So he might be purchasing another five tons from one of his neighbor, or even perhaps making some money from providing a custom winemaking facility or operations for one of his neighbors. But here, in this instance, his own farm produced 50% of the total volume that he processed. Then suppose that after a few years, this Pinot Noir wine label really flourished, but he had no more vineyard capacity to increase his own Pinot Noir grape production. He could still pass this test as long as he kept the 20 tons of his own Pinot Noir grapes and made wine from no more than a total of 200 tons of grapes. Again, this could be either purchasing it from other vineyards or custom crushing for others. But here he is processing one half of his total farm production, the half that happened to be Pinot Noir, but in his farm was producing 10% of the total volume that went through that winery operation. So that explains some of the rationale. It gives an entity the flexibility to grow and obtain some of the benefits from having a processing facility, but still has to be directly related to the farming enterprise. Section 4 of the bill, I'm actually referring to the Dash 2 amendments, provides a phase-in of these volume tests just to ensure that we allow investments to be encouraged for new on-farm processing activities. Otherwise, a new on-farm processor wouldn't have the records to substantiate that production history, so we provided that phase-in period. After the records are available, they have to be provided, and they have to be kept for 10 years for audit purposes. Sections 3 and 4 and 7 and 8 then get down to the policy, and that is to allow these eligible taxpayers who have jumped through all of these hoops to claim a state income tax credit in an amount that is roughly based on what they would have paid or what they most likely paid on property taxes at the local levels of government against these machinery and equipment. And, of course, the credit can't exceed the tax liability in any one year, but we have the carry-forward provisions. Creating this formula, then, it avoids administrative burden on local government from having to separately list these kinds of equipment. It reduces their fiscal burden in that respect as well. Then subsections 5 and 6 of Section 3 to then describe how the credit is calculated, and we went through that in detail just a bit earlier. Again, this is because local tax accounts don't provide line-by-line assessments of this type of equipment. So instead, as a part of the work group, we look to see how those assessed values would be created, and that's the kind of methodology that we rely on today. Taking best records that we have available from the farm producers already, using the tax rates that appear on the local tax accounts that are paid, trying to use as much existing information as possible to make it accurate but also streamline, and again, easing the administrative burden on local and state government and the Department of Revenue's own administrative burdens for looking at these credits that may be taken. So the credits taken by multiplying the taxpayer's effective property tax rate, which they can calculate or may even be pre-printed in some counties from their property tax account forms, times this adjusted basis that we talked about earlier of the qualified machining equipment. And you were exactly right, Representative Witt, in that the Section 179 amounts are essentially irrelevant to the property tax equation, and so that's why we feel like it makes sense for these policy purposes to add them back into this calculation. Finally, then, Section 7 of the bill would create a separate property tax classification for rural property on which these kinds of on-farm processing facilities are located, and then gives those taxpayers the option to exclude the income approach from their appraisal. And that's currently available if you deem your facility an industrial plant, but for a number of reasons that are probably obvious to you, we'd calling yourself an industrial plant out in the farm zone can create some other burdens and could confuse local treatment of those operations. So that's why Section 7 appears as a part of this legislation as well. And then it allow that classification will allow us essentially to track the growth of investment in this important sector of Oregon's rural economy. So that's all I have. If you have any questions, I'm more than happy to take them, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is sort of a peripheral question. Caught my attention when you were going through the Section 3, subsection 3, mm-hmm. B and C, and you talked about contiguous land.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of, because we had a little bit of a discussion about contiguous plots and, you know, and how that worked together. And under what circumstance might someone have machinery on a property that wasn't assessed but was contiguous to an assessed property?
In most cases, that would occur if you had, say, the home site with the farm and other farm buildings, perhaps the winery or wherever the mm-hmm. processing facility is, separated perhaps by a county road from where the farming actually appears. That classifies as contiguous, and that contiguous is a word that appears in the special assessment portions of the statutes as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Would there ever be a circumstance where it was only contiguous, or would contiguous always be... Would there always be a sort of a normal plot of land, if you will, I'm using the wrong vocabulary, I'm sure, and a contiguous?
I think that there certainly could be instances where perhaps if it was on the boundary of a zoning area, special assessment, if you're not in a farm zone in particular, is key to farm income. Mm-hmm. So if that adjacent parcel didn't happen to be in a farm zone, but was, say, in a rural residential 10 zone that wasn't generating enough income itself to achieve special assessment, but again was clearly tied mm-hmm. to the adjacent farming enterprise, that would apply as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me follow up on that, and maybe contiguous really applies to the land.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the it sounds funny when you read the machinery and equipment is located on or contiguous to land.
Right.
Machinery and equipment never would be contiguous.
Right.
The land that the machinery equipment is on would be contiguous.
We may want to
wordsmith that a little bit, because it suggests that the machinery and equipment is somehow contiguous. Mm-hmm. What we're really getting at is the parcel on which the machinery is located being contiguous to the specially assessed parcel.
That's right. And I think more importantly, Mr. Chairman, on the immediately next section, provides the machine equipment, most importantly, has to be used on that kind of property.
Mm-hmm. Are there some wineries in Oregon where the wineries and the vineyards are miles apart?
Yeah, there are some. Particularly if those then, if that winemaking operation is not located on land that was specially assessed for farm zones, that wouldn't apply. Now, under this bill, the crops don't have to come necessarily from that immediately adjacent property, because we may have a winery associated with one vineyard on site and other vineyards, you know, some miles away. But as long as processing occurs on that specially assessed farmland zone, it'd be okay.
As I recall, the discussion from last session, and I think what we're still getting at here is not strictly, but more like a vertically integrated operation here, whereas the processing facility that is strictly a processing facility situated out by the highway is more a manufacturing kind of entity than an integrated agricultural processing operation. Is that right?
That's right, Mr. Chairman. This isn't intended really to be a geographic restriction as much as it is to be a check to make sure that we're talking about farmers like Bernie rather than, mm-hmm. you know, a large potato manufacturing mm-hmm. plant that's located in Boardman,
mm-hmm. for instance. I had a question, this kind of goes back to what I was asking Dexter earlier, and I think I have a better sense of what I was getting at. If you'd look on line 13 of the dash 2 amendments on page 1, we have the farm operator. This gets at the operator. This is distinct from ownership. This is the operator, the person or the entity, whatever that is, that operates the farming business. And then in order to qualify for the credit, on lines 10 through 12 of page 2, you've got the criteria that the machine and equipment be owned by the farm operator or by a person who is related to the farm operator. And I'm trying to get these. I know, for instance, that you'd have situations where you might have an LLC that actually owns the land and a corporation that operates the entity. Mm-hmm. And I assume we would, the intent would be to treat those as qualifying for the credit. Does this language get us there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this language does get us there, and that's exactly why it's designed to do that. We don't want to give farmers the disadvantage by this bill to discourage them to enjoy those liability-protecting entities that are available. Specifically, once you start processing a product, especially into consumer goods, you're looking at more risks of product liability and the wine industry, liquor liability. Is that
so? On line 11, you're satisfied that language. Person who is related to the farm operator is broad enough to encompass a LLC that or a corporation that's under common ownership with an LLC that owns the facility?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's right. Section 267 of the Internal Revenue Code contemplates corporate entities, LLCs, with similar ownership structures.
Very good. Any other questions? Okay. All right, thanks very much. Don Schellenberger. Don, did you want a moment of silence before you testify? You left a gap here.
You wanted to go last.
Yeah.
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman. For agriculture. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Also today representing the tree fruit growers, the Oregon Seed Council, the Oregon Dairymen's Association, all who support House Bill 2033. Couple comments to Representative Witt. Asked a few questions there, and I would start by saying that we welcome the friendly amendment that he would offer, spoke of earlier regarding the getting the tax credit on all of the value of the equipment, not just the part that was not rapidly depreciated, if I understand all this parlance correctly. But that would be something that we would encourage. And then secondly, maybe just a little bit of discussion about the method of assessing when the assessor comes out and assesses the farm building, there's equipment that is bolted down or what's called the not readily movable. That equipment is assessed as a part of the building, and they don't separate that out separately and give you a separate value for that. And that's what would make it difficult for you to identify what the exact value and the assessed value of that equipment is because they simply don't separate it out. Moving on with the testimony here, the recent tractor rally in which I was a participant on my, quote, battered red tractor, unquote, and just a side note, my wife was greatly concerned about that. She suggested that my tractor may want to file a defamation of character suit against the Statesman Journal, and I suggested to her that I may need to employ the services of Representative Shetterly shortly. Surely someone will charge me with tractor abuse. Tractor is actually a pretty nice tractor, 1973 model, but still in very good condition. And I've a little taken offense at what was said there. But nevertheless, the tractor rally highlighted the very difficult financial situation in which agriculture finds itself today. And I'll not bore you with all the numbers, but suffice it to say that this is the worst economy for agriculture in over 20 years. I was visiting with one fifth-generation grower last week during the rally, and he told me he could go one more year and if he isn't able to increase his position, financial position, this year, he's out of business. I think that demonstrates the crisis that agriculture is in. And this is not uncommon to hear this kind of comment these days. In addition to the poor general economy, we've had the bankruptcy of fruit and vegetable processors, AgriPack and now AgriFrozen recently, and the grass seed buyer of ABT. Oregon farmers have lost millions of dollars, and now the big question for many of them is, what can I grow? You don't have markets, you don't have processors. You can grow it, but if you can't move it, there isn't any sense growing it. And that's a big concern. Even prior to these bankruptcies, we have seen the trend of farmers identifying niche markets and adding on-farm processing as a way of adding value to their product in an effort to blunt the low raw commodity prices. In many cases, the particular commodity processors and wholesalers are forcing the farmer to be their storage and banker with no comparable increase in prices. This has particularly been true in the grass seed industry. They'll contract with you, but they won't pay on that crop until 1 or 2 years out. And it's not unique to the grass seed industry. And so they're forcing you. They don't even come and get the product. You keep the product in your warehouse, so they're forcing you to store it. And then you're the banker besides, because they work on your capital. They don't pay you for the product for a long time, so they can use their money for something else. And so that has contributed to the poor economic condition for agriculture as well. I say all this to make the point in the case that we should be encouraging growers who can, and not everyone has the expertise or the means to do so, to diversify their farm operation to include value-added activities. The recent bankruptcies I mentioned earlier also illustrate the value of on-farm activities by individual farmers. First, because the individual remains in control of his product, and second, because of its size, when a commercial processor falls, it has a huge impact on the whole agricultural economy and the state. If one individual operation succumbs economically, the larger economy is not greatly affected. Again, the ABT bankruptcy issue is an illustration of that. That was 30 or 40 companies that they put together, and they collapsed the whole bunch. It put a huge hit on the agricultural economy of the state. On the other hand, you may have read in the paper, Statesman Journal, Monday morning regarding the fire in a fruit processing facility near Dallas. That's our place.
I was gonna say, yeah.
It was our place. I'm not playing the sympathy card here, but we sold it prior to the fire.
Missouri?
Yeah. But so there are people who he buys products from. Now, if he's not able to stay in business because of that fire, that isn't going to have a huge impact on the state economy, whereas the ABT will have a huge impact on the state economy. So the more we can encourage on-farm processing of individual farm by individual farmers, that spreads out that risk in the state. HB 2033 is really an investment in the future of Oregon's economy. On a statewide basis, it assists in stabilizing the economy, plus it will add state revenue with increased value of the sale of commodities that would otherwise be sold as raw product out of state to out-of-state processors. Some of these on-farm processors are a big advantage locally, simply because they allow themselves and their neighbors to get their commodity into a condition where it can be stored rather than having to sell it during the high supply and low price time of harvest. In our particular case, it was what's now referred to as a dried plum dehydrator, changing it from prunes to plums. Gilberts can do it, the hazelnuts, we can do it, I guess. But you have a product that's very, that will spoil easily. They'll last 24 to 48 hours, and then they begin to get a fungus and brown rot and deteriorate. If you can dry them, then they're in a condition where you can hold them for 6 months, 12 months, 18 months before, and then you can pick your market and get a better supply. So there's that aspect of even having on-farm processing available. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's a time for the state of Oregon to make some bold moves to improve the agricultural economy of Oregon. The Oregon Farm Bureau highly recommends the passage of House Bill 2033 as one of the first steps. And thank you for the opportunity to make these important comments today.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Schellenberg? All right. Very good. Thank you, Don. That concludes the sign-up sheet on this bill. Is there anybody else here in the room that wants to step forward? Tom, you're just here for the enlightenment? Okay.
In case
there's questions. All right. Then with that, we will close the public hearing. Did I hear there was some discussion of amendments? Was that while I was out of the room? Or we'll find out before we bring this back up. Yeah, did you have some amendments on that? We're not going to go into work session anyway.
On 2033?
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Okay, you were just commenting. Okay, I didn't think so. That was more comments just about how the bill works. Yeah. In that case, then, we'll close the public hearing, and we are adjourned.